This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling-Biru. Hey everyone, welcome to the show. This week marks the finale of Shogun, the miniseries created by Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks, based on the 1975 novel. I'm so happy to talk to talented director Hiromi Kamada about the stunning work that went into this series. Historical accuracy, thrilling storylines, and powerful representation. There were so many incredible details. Over 100 people from the costume department were on set the day that Ms. Kamada filmed that incredible no theater scene in her episode Ladies of the Willow World. She talks about how she showed the actors Ingmar Bergman's persona and Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love to prepare for maybe one of the sexiest scenes on a TV show this season, but that hardly includes a touch. Hiromi Kamada, whose directorial credits include TV series like Selena, Let the Right One In, and Monarch, Legacy of Monsters, was born in Mexico City to a Mexican mother and Japanese father, a cinematographer. As you'll hear, working on Shogun was a meaningful and powerful connection to her own background. I was particularly happy to talk to Hiromi Kamada about the episode she directed, which very much centers on the powerful women of the show. One of our main characters, Mariko, played by Anna Sawai, Lady Ochiba, mother to the heir, played by Fumi Nikaido, and Yuki Kuri's Kiku, a renowned courtesan. John Blackthorne is played by Cosmo Jarvis, and Lord Tokunaga by Hiroyuki Sanada.
The time has come for us to turn towards Torunaga as an ally.
Hiromi Kamada, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. I am very, very excited to be joining you. Thank you for inviting me on. Yeah, let's take it away.
Congratulations on this incredible show. I have to say that first. Shogun is absolutely spellbinding, such an epic show. I want to dig into work that you did specifically on Ladies of the Willow World and other things. But first, I want to know a little bit about background. So I'm speaking to you from Mexico City. You're half Mexican and your father is Japanese and a cinematographer, I understand. How did this mixture of rich culture affect you as an artist, as a director?
Yes, I was born and raised in Mexico City. This is where all my love stories are. So this is where I try to live, but also, you know, wherever a good story or a good character takes me. So my father, he was born and raised in Japan. He worked a lot for Mr. Toshiro Mifune. He worked at Mifune Productions. He started as a focus puller, but then became a cinematographer. And early on in the 60s, he came to Mexico to shoot some footage for Japan. And he fell in love with the country. So he came back, asked Mr. Mifune to write a recommendation letter, which Mr. Mifune wrote very kindly in Spanish.
Oh, and wow.
I have the letter. I have it. And it's kind of, you know, that museum material. And so he came here in 1969, he met my mom, they fell in love, they had my sister, they had me, and he started working, you know, as a DP, since he, like, 2 weeks later after he came. So So I basically grew up on set, and you know, I was running around stages and being a pain in the butt to my father. And I told him, maybe I was, I guess, like 14 when I said, I want to be a director like Spielberg. And my dad was like, oh, God, no. So
it worked out.
Yeah, it worked out.
When Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks were the creators of this show, when you started with them, what was the sort of approach that they wanted to do with Shogun?
Well, I think the most attractive approach to me was, you know, being the daughter of a Japanese man, growing up watching Karate Kid, growing up watching Steven Seagal movies, because I was also obsessed with Steven Seagal, don't ask me why. Obviously, the representation of Japanese in cinema, Western cinema, no, wasn't something that my father felt proud of at all. No, my dad, you know, he used to play for me. He used to make me watch Kurosawa films. You know, he made me watch Mizoguchi films. So obviously, the misrepresentation, and I'm gonna call it like that, of Japanese culture in Western cinema was kind of embarrassing to him. Like, maybe the way I feel when I see, you know, a Mexican in a burro with a sombrero in 2024, you know, it's like, so when Justin and Rachel and Ed McDonald, the producer, approached to me, they said, you know, this is not a show about East meets West, you know, it is a show that goes for the psychological. This is a show that wants, you know, to be accurate, that wants to honor the Japanese culture, that wants to capture the Japanese soul. This is a show about the dual relationship between entrapment and freedom. No, this is a show about agency. Then that became a whole other concept. No, that became a very engaging and wonderful project that I wanted to be a part of.
And particularly the women in this series very much show in your episode. There's an incredible line where Mariko says, women are simply at war. Talk to me a little bit about the women, their historical counterparts, and what you wanted to bring in terms of the women of Shogun.
Well, women in the Sengoku period, of the stature, obviously, that the women we are witnessing, they did have agency, you know, but they had agency through their husbands. They had agency through, you know, men had to be on the way for them, you know, to be able to complete a task, to be able to have a purpose. They served the Lord. We can see it very clear in Mariko. To me, the fact of capturing and approaching, you know, the different sides of being a woman in that Japanese feudal period was very interesting. No, you just said something that is very important for the episode, which is that line that Mariko says to Toranaga. No, a woman is simply at war, right? That is, to me, what unlocks the title of the episode. No, Ladies of the Willow, because every woman in the show is a leader. It's a lady in the Willow world, and every woman is, you know, is having their own war. No, Mariko is at war because she's determined to accomplish her mission. No, with Toranaga, her father is a fallen hero. You know, whose mission was unfinished, so she has to finish it for him. No matter what her feelings, her impulses towards, you know, Blackthorn, whatever, anything that's outside, that has to be left outside. No, she has to make a choice. No, she has to keep her feelings and impulses under control, you know, because she has a bigger purpose. In the case of Ochiba, you know, she's trying to get revenge.
There's an incredible scene you built, the No Theater. Talk about the research for this and how you worked to get this scene to life.
Look, I'm gonna give the credit to Kalin Puente, who's an associate producer on the show, who was the writer on set with me. Kalin was the research coordinator. So by the time I got to Shogun, there was this, you know, a lot of information that was kind of already packed for me, you know, because we're talking about centuries and centuries, and where no theater comes from, and, you know, the region where no theater comes, and how it evolved with time, and how it started, you know, and how it became a traveling thing, and then how it became a representation for lords, you know, it changes mm-hmm. a lot. So I must say that if I had to, you know, as an episodic director, I had to dwell into the research on my own, I would have been probably stuck for 5 years, you know, researching for the scene. So I gotta give the credit to my friend and the very talented Kalin Puente, who, when I got into the show, she already had, you know, all this information ready for me. And also we had our historian, and we had three different advisors, right? So by the time I got to the show, everything was kind of just built for me not to worry about the historic accuracy, because everything was, you know, on point. What I had to worry about was, you know, how are we going to tell the story? How are we going to capture the behavior of all the characters that are around the play? And what this play, and watching this play, what does it mean for Lady Ochiba? What does it mean for Oshido? What does it mean for Kiyama? That was a hard part of the scene, no? Because all the play was, you know, written by this wonderful Knoll Company Theater for the show. But to me, the challenge was trying to accomplish both, you know, shooting the play in the most beautiful way, honoring it, you know, having, you know, this amount of time on, you know, international TV to give, you know, the world a glimpse of the beauty of the right. depth of no theater, but also not forgetting that there's a reason for that play. That's the story, that's history we're watching, right? And as all these characters are plotting, because in the end they're hostages inside the castle, there's also Lady Ochiba who's watching her past.
And you were talking about the research. What about in terms of costume and set design? The women's costumes in particular, and the clothing seem so much to be part of the story itself.
Yeah, the production design, you know, Helen Jarvis, our production designer, she's just a genius. And but also, no theater has a very specific, you know, it has a background that it is what it is, and it has, you know, measures. So we just had to be very accurate with, you know, with what no theater does inside the castle, obviously. But in terms of costumes, I gotta give it to Carlos Rosario, who is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant costume designer. My fiance is a costume designer, and I must tell you, I respect, you know, a costume, and I am very, very, I work very close with my costume designers, and I must say, what Carlos did is just something out of this planet.
Oh, it's amazing. So many, and just the wealth of the costumes in this series.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Calafato, and I'm the creator of 7 Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.
For my episode, he started designing the costumes probably around 4 months before, months before we shot, for one episode, you know. We shot in February, yeah, and he probably started designing in November, you know. Every single costume that you see on the No Theater scene was built from scratch. I used to laugh a lot because he used to tell me, this is kind of my version of the, you know, the Met Gala. Yeah, and in terms of you know, as a narrative tool, which costume is, you know, to me, probably one of the closest mm-hmm. tools for narrative in terms of character and actors, it's a power display, you know, in the way they're dressed. It's probably the higher your rank, the more layers you wear as a lady, for example. No, so I don't remember how many layers Fumini Kaido was wearing, but I do remember that walking for 1 meter, it took her, you know, it was very heavy, very, very, very heavy. Probably, I'm trying out of the back of my mind, talking to Carlos, probably more than 125 people from his team were on set that day working, you know, all the pieces that there were built, they were built in Vancouver, but all the fabrics, if I remember correctly, were brought from Japan.
And I want to talk to you about, because you managed to make one of the sexiest scenes I've seen on television without any physical contact at all. And I understand that you made your actors research for this. Tell me about that. They had to watch some stuff.
Yeah, they did. They had to watch some stuff. You know, talking with Justin, you know, Justin and Rachel, we both spoke about the remains of the day, you know, as one. I made Cosmo rewatch because he already loved it. He's a huge fan of Anthony Hopkins and a big fan of Emma Thompson, so he rewatched it. Anna, for example, she's 32. She'd never seen, you know, Persona, Bergman. So I made her watch that as well. Also, that was spoken previously with Rachel, both Rachel and Justin. And I'm a huge fan of Wong Kar-wai. So obviously, In the Mood for Love, Chungking Express, you know, they meant a lot. It was probably the most challenging scene. I guess the no theater scene and, you know, the tea house scene to me were the most challenging ones, because talking about Bergman, for example, I knew that no matter what I could shoot or we could shoot, nothing could be sexier than whatever was happening in the mind of Mariko and Blackthorne at that moment. And that was to me the challenge. That was to me the objective. I mean, if I could capture that, then, you know, hopefully people would engage, people would care, would connect with that. So we rehearsed it a lot of times, because the way you block a scene in Shogun, it's entirely different from what I had worked on Fido Japan. They, you know, the movement, the way women move, the way, you know, characters, it's a rules are other rules, let's just say. So there wasn't much leeway. So the tea house scene, I rehearsed, you know, in every human possible way, because there was a lot of blocking. You know, we cut a lot of it, but originally, if I might remember, the wonderful Megan Huang, who wrote the script, who wrote this wonderful scene, might correct me, but I think the original version was around 7 pages. So we have three characters there, you know, that and all these layers are happening and they're not moving except for one moment, which is when Mariko stands next to Kiku and then eclipses her, you know, and then takes over her voice to express. So we had a lot of rehearsals. We had not for movement, but for, you know, for emotion, for intention, for layers, for, you know, for what was happening in whose head and what, you know, what we needed to engage, what reactions we couldn't miss. You know, there was a lot of work behind that scene. So I am very proud and grateful that people connected with it, because it needed to be, in the words of Justin Marks, the sexiest scene. And I think it was, you know.
It is, and it makes it so much more powerful too. There's so much going on in that scene between every, it's like a triangle between every character, and the idea of sort of why they're there, what the duty is, what they can't do, what they can do. And everything is happening not only in their dialogue, but who you're watching. It's really an incredible scene.
Thank you so much. And I have to give credit, obviously, to the actors, particularly Anna, you know, and the actors who plays Kiku, both Yuka and Anna were both incredible to work with, and, you know, just kind of took the scene into their own hands and into their own spirit, and they became one voice, which was, for me and Cosmo, it was just amazing to witness, right?
You were talking about sort of being an episodic director. How does that work from, and when you're working with so many different directors, how do you keep the show on the same approach as was thought of from the beginning?
Well, you know, in the case of Shogun, it was a huge, huge, huge show in scale. And by the time I got there, it was completely established. You know, Jonathan Mantuleken had already established episode 1 and 2. The rules were entirely different. But the way I see it as an episodic director is like you go into a construction building, right? It's a building. You know, the foundation is there. You're building a level. You're building a floor. And you want to make sure that the floor is solid. You know, it goes with the architecture. it's also that it also has your own kind of DNA, your own kind of soul, whatever it is, whatever spark you can put there. That's the challenge. No, it's not. It's because it, in the end, you know, you're a little shooting star that comes and goes, then comes the others.
And you bring your power to it. So you can definitely see it there. You've mentioned so many women also behind the scenes that you've been working with. Did you see that reflected in the in the episode?
Absolutely. That's what I love so much about the episode. You know, the directorial monitors, you know, you have your monitors and you have your little tent. I had a Japanese script supervisor, Katsuoko, and I had a Canadian script supervisor, Erin. I had Kalin Puente with me on set. We had our assistant director trainee, Elise Mortier, and the five of us were there the whole time, you know, every single day. And we used to call it the 5-1 club because all of us were very short. Anna, she might kill me for saying this, but Anna is 5'2 and Fumi is 5'1. So I remember we were saying, like, okay, if you're above 5'1, you cannot come in.
You're not in the group.
You're not in the 5'1 club. This is only ladies that are below 5'2. So the power of that, you know, and Rachel, I mean, Rachel kind of became my therapist because, you know, her office was next door to mine. The power of Rachel, you know, the honesty of Rachel, working with her, and the clarity of every single female character on the show is threaded by her. So to work with women like that, you know, women that are just incredible and generous and smart and thoughtful and talented, it's a privilege. When you jump into that pool, you know, you either step up or you drown, because all of them are so strong.
Ah, you keep each other floating. When this airs, our conversation airs, we will have seen the entirety of Shogun. For you, what is Mariko's storyline? What should we take away from it as viewers?
Well, I think in the case of Mariko, I love her persistence and I love her decision. You know, I love that life has so many distractions. Life can make you change your decisions, your choices. Life can shape you. But when, you know, when your soul and your character is so well built and your aim is on something, and you just go for it, no matter what life might, you know, no matter what the tide might bring, it's something that I admire completely in Mariko. The way she dies, she finally dies for her purpose. She honors her father. And to me, coming from a Japanese father, that means the world, you know, because I did grow up those values, you know. It's a strange mix, but while working on Shogun, I thought a lot about my father, a lot. Probably Shogun, as far as now, is the only work I've done that my father is completely proud of, mm-hmm. you know, in the sense of, well, Mariko's storyline, as I said, she made it, you mm-hmm. know. Everybody's going to say, oh, no, my God, she, you know, she died. Well, for a purpose.
And for every other woman's purpose, too, also.
Of course, because in the end, that's something I love about our show and the story, is that, you know, Crimson Sky is not this huge battle with a thousand soldiers. You know, Mariko is a Trojan horse. That's what Toranaga sends into the castle of Osaka that changes everything. It's her. So to me, that's the Mariko, by far, is the most powerful character of the whole show. That scene between her and Lady Ochiba, when, you know, Lady Ochiba tries to change her mind. They talk about their childhood, you know. There's this beautiful, Fumi Nikaido is a beast of an actor. She's and a pleasure to work with. There's this moment when Lady Ochiba turns around and you can see the tears falling, you know, because she knows that Mariko is she's going to die. She knows. But Mariko stands on her ground and no matter what, you know. It's a very heartbreaking episode. My favorite, if I must say, by far, is episode 9. But also I believe that the seeds of that relationship and where that comes from, that backstory, is set on episode 6.
Ladies of the Absolutely.
World, right?
Yeah. And I just have to talk about Toranaga. What a character. I mean, it feels like he's always with very much patience setting things up and letting them happen somehow.
Yeah, I think he's a mastermind. you know, he's the best chess player that there is because he's always three moves ahead of everybody. He's a great poker player too, because he never shows, but he does in a way. Episode 8, directed by my friend Emmanuel Osei-Kefor, which is also one of my favorite episodes. That heartbreaking scene between Hiromatsu and him, you know, when Hiromatsu commits seppuku. Mm. And legend, Hiro is just a legend. Hiroyuki Sanada is just a legend. And I'm going to say, hands down, he is the most professional, talented, passionate, wonderful actor I've ever had the privilege and honor to direct.
And he's a producer on the show as well.
Yes. You know, I told him, like, Hiro, you need to take, you know, polyester.
Polyester agrees.
She's a Hiroyuki fan.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, when Hiro was not shooting, he was on set every day as a producer and always from a place of love and respect for the show and for his directors, you know, like the way he approached me, you know, and gave me one little note, this little note, you know, making sure that every single detail on the show was accurate with the Japanese culture, with the Japanese feudal cinema piece, no? So what he did is just beyond human. He's just a hero.
And what's next for you?
I'd love to do a movie, you know, having conversations here in Mexico, in the States as well. I would love to do a movie, I guess. That's where I come from, you know. That's where my dad started. That's where I started. I started in cinema doing movies. I would love the possibility to do a movie. And in terms of TV, you know, just keep looking for shows that I would love to watch. Character-driven shows, that characters that are messy, that are layered, that hit all the colors of the rainbow, you know. Those are the kind of shows that I want to definitely chase. I'm in conversations for another show that I'm really interested in. Fingers crossed I do get it. And if I do get it in a couple of months, you'll know.
Wonderful.
And that's pretty much it.
Thank you so much, Hirumi, for joining me. I really thought it was some stunning direction on your episode, and I was so glad you had the time to talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Christina. That means the world to me because, you know, it's a very intimate character episode, and that's very hard. Sometimes to me, it's harder than, you know, that monsters and action and chases.
Yes.
And because the tension comes from the heart, and that's the hardest to pull off.
Thank you to Hiromi Kamata. You can watch the entirety of Shogun on FX or Disney Plus. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Confidential, a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.